This is Audible.
Fantastic Audio presents Jupiter by Ben Bova. Read by Christian Noble and David Warner.
This is Harlan Ellison. I've been asked to do a few prefatory remarks about my friend Ben Bova, Dr. Ben Bova, Dr. Benjamin William Bova, born November 8th, 1932 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Ben and I are very close. We've known each other since, I think, 1962. We're very, very close friends. I adore him. I mean, I just love the man. And when doing introductions about people, you know, if I don't know them very well, it's easy. I can cobble up almost anything that's needed to be said. But when it's someone like Joe Hensley or Lester Del Rey or Henry Slessor or Bob Block or Phil Farmer, Norman Spinrad, these are people that mean so much to me that they're such a fixed and substantial part of my world. Like Isaac Asimov was, that I could no more casually introduce them than I could fly without the aid of an airline. I met Ben, I guess it was 1962, at one of Damon Knight's Milford Writers Workshops in Milford, Pike County, Pennsylvania. We became friends almost instantly. There is a story that I could tell you another time about how Ben's then wife, his first wife, Rosa, cold cocked me with a right. I mean, literally knocked me unconscious. But that's another story. Ben is so commanding of respect on every possible level, one might conceive that introducing him for me is like talking about one's father, although he's only, you know, a couple of years older than I am, or big brother or blood brother. The guy's done 103 books, for pity's sake. And I got a press release. Now, let me go through these papers. Yeah, I've got this piece of paper here. It says, Dr. Ben Bova started writing fiction in the late 1940s. That's horsepucky. Horsepucky. The man's first story was published in 1960. It was called A Long Way Back. His first book was in 59. It was a young adult book, The Star Conquerors. I don't know who prepares these things. 1940. The guy was born in 32, for pity's sake. He would have been 6 years old, 8 years old. But he's been at it ever since then. And he's written fiction. He's written nonfiction. And he was involved in the U.S. space program even 2 years before the creation of NASA. And he was, until recently, the publisher of GalaxyOnline.com, the internet, what do they call it, super site. He was the editor of Analog Science Fiction after John Campbell died. He was the fiction editor at Omni Magazine. He wrote teaching films with Nobel laureate scientists. He's the president emeritus of the National Space Society and a past president of SFWA, the Science Fiction Fantasy Writers of America. And let me tell you something, being president of that group is like being the head gargoyle in the lunatic asylum. He's also won 6 Hugo Awards. He's worked with Woody Allen and George Lucas and even Gene Roddenberry on film and television projects. He's the regular science guest on CBS Morning News. He's on the board of contributors of USA Today, blah, 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 blah. I mean, just on and on and on and on and on. His recent string of novels began with Mars in 1992 and now includes Moonrise 96, Moon War 98, Return to Mars 99, Venus 2000. And as I record this, he's got Jupiter forthcoming in 2001. The guy is a writing machine. We talked today when I called him and I said, I'm going to be doing an introduction. I said, is there anything particular you want to say? He said, yeah, tell him I'm very specific about the way I like my spaghetti, al dente. Yeah, I got it. The most important thing about Ben Bova that you need to know is that he is the only Gentile I know who can tell a joke well. See, this was Hitler's big mistake, killing Jews. He killed anybody who could get off a good one-liner. Because the Goyim just can't. I mean, no offense. They bake great bread. They drive taxis well. But they can't tell jokes properly. Ben can do that. I guess it's because he's an Italian. Anyhow, Ben is my pal. He's my buddy. He has helped me enormous number of times. And together, when we wrote the story Brillo, It was a great Christmas present for me. It was sold to John Campbell at Analog Science Fiction. And Ben called me on a Christmas, whatever year that was, way back. And he said, guess what? You have now sold to John Campbell, which fulfilled a lifelong dream of mine. Later, that story was ripped off when we did it as a television series, and it was ripped off by ABC and Paramount and sued them, and I won $750,000. So you see, knowing Ben Bova is not only pleasant, it is also salutary and rewarding financially. And so, now having learned all of these important things, of course not about his wooden leg or the fact that he's wanted by the police in Bermuda, I think you should settle back, cup your hand behind your ears, and listen to Jupiter by Ben Bova.
Prologue, Orbital Station Gold. It took six of them to drown him. Reluctantly, grudgingly, Grant Archer had stripped himself naked, as they had ordered him to do. But once they pushed him to the edge of the big tank, he knew he would not go into it without a fight. The augmented gorilla grabbed Grant's right arm. She was careful not to snap his bones, but her powerful grip was painful all the same. Two of the human guards held his left arm, while a third wrapped him around the middle, and still another lifted his bare feet off the deck so he couldn't get any leverage for his wild-eyed struggles. All this in nearly total silence. Grant didn't scream or roar at them. He didn't plead or curse. The only sounds were the scuffing of the guards' boots on the cold metal deck plates, the hard gasps of their labored breathing, and Grant's own panicked, desperate panting. The guard captain grimly, efficiently grasped Grant's debilitated head in both big meaty hands and pushed his face into the tank of thick, oily liquid. Grant squeezed his eyes shut and held his breath until his chest felt as if it would burst. He was burning inside, suffocating, drowning. The pain was unbearable. He couldn't breathe. He dared not breathe. No matter what they had told him, he knew down at the deepest level of his being that this was going to kill him. No air. Can't breathe. Reflex overpowered his mind. Despite himself, despite his terror, he sucked in a breath and gagged. He tried to scream, to cry out, to beg for help or mercy. His lungs filled with the icy liquid. His whole body spasmed, shuddered with the last hope of life as they pushed his naked body all the way into the tank with a final, pitiless shove, and he sank down deeper and deeper. He opened his eyes. There were lights down there. He was breathing. Coughing, choking, his body racked with uncontrollable spasms, but he was breathing. The liquid filled his lungs and he could breathe it. Just like regular air, they had told him. A lie, a vicious lie. It was cold and thick, utterly foreign, alien, slimy, and horrible. But he could breathe. He sank toward the lights, blinking, squinting in their glare. He saw that there were other naked, hairless bodies down there waiting for him. "Welcome to the team," a sarcastic voice boomed in his ears, deep, slow, reverberating. Another voice, not as loud but even more basso profundo, said, "Okay, let's get him prepped for the surgery."
Book One. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Far from my deliverance are the words of my groaning. Psalm 22.
Grant Armstrong Archer III. Despite being born into one of the oldest families in Oregon, Grant Archer grew up in an environment that was far from affluent. His earliest memories were of watching his mother rummaging through piles of hand-me-down clothes at the Goodwill shop, looking for sweaters and gym shoes that weren't too shabby to wear to school. His father was a Methodist minister in the little suburb of Salem where Grant grew up, respected as a man of the cloth, but not taken too seriously in the community because he was, in the words of one of the golf club widows, church mouse poor. Poor as far as money was concerned. But Grant's mother always told him that he was rich in the gift of intelligence. It was his mother, who worked in one of the multifarious offices of the New Morality in the state capital, who encouraged Grant's interest in science. Most of the new morality officials were suspicious of